You are listening to My Art Broker Talks. My Art Broker connects buyers and sellers of blue chip prints and editions, specializing in original prints and multiples, in particular pop, contemporary, and urban art. Hosted by Charlotte Stewart.
Fanny Pereira is a New York art consultant who creates some extraordinary collections for some extraordinary people, with a twist, because Fanny's people don't actually exist. But with a client list including Logan Roy and Bobby Axelrod, she is the eyes and style behind some of our best known, best loved, and perhaps best loathed billionaire collectors. Hi, Fanny.
Hello, Charlotte.
Thank you so much for coming on the My Art Broker podcast. We are huge fans of both Billions and Succession, and you've done a huge amount of other projects as well. We've got so much to discuss today. I think I'd love to start by hearing how you got into becoming a curator for such extraordinary characters.
Well, it's all thanks to Scott Rudin about 25 years ago, when copyrights laws start being enforced in the film industry. And he, as a major art collector, figured that he should have somebody who knew something about art and had contacts or an artist to get the real thing. Because it's the process is the same to get a reproduction of a real artwork than having scenics create fake artworks. And until now, I think the art world didn't see the film business as an art form and vice, you know, and so there was really no links between them. And so I think basically we started creating that bridge. And it was really then that artists started wanting to have their artwork reproduced on films. Before that, it was very hard for anyone to have access to them.
It's a sort of very high level product placement, I suppose, for artists to be able to showcase works in these stories.
Well, it has become, but they certainly didn't see it that way until then. Some of them now actually, you know, it's part of their provenance if an artwork has been seen on a set. But obviously, we also use public domain artworks and, you know, but the process is the same, whether it's, you know, it's a multi-million dollar artwork or it's a five-year-old's artwork that you put on a fridge. I mean, I do all of them. You still have to get the parental, you know, to sign the clearance form for, you know, drawings that if the character has, you know, small children or the, you know, wherever they would have it. So the value of the artwork is not really relevant as far as the process.
How interesting. So absolutely every piece of art, whether it be the five-year-old's work on the fridge, goes through you. And I suppose the characterization of that family life and what that artwork might look like on that person's fridge in that particular scene. Tell me about the process of taking something like Succession scene by scene. Where's the starting point?
Well, the starting point is you read the script like everyone else, and then it's really a team effort between the producers, the director, and the production designer, the costume designer. I mean, we all work together, and we just we create these, you know, we're basically creating characters who don't exist, and we just, you know, we never call them by the name of the actor. It's always by the name of the character, and they become our relatives or friends or nemesis, whatever. And we sort of figure out where they, you know, the production designer with the location manager will figure out where they live. We figure out who they are. And then, you know, then it's for me to do the research. And it's usually always a composite of different people I know. I also have an actor who has precise idea that, you know, of what he would like, and then we talk about it. I mean, I think the most interesting collaboration I've ever had was with Donald Sutherland on The Undoing. And when we first met, we each had a list of 10 artists that we thought his character would have. And out of the 10, we both had 9 of them were the same. So we were exactly on the same wavelength.
And who were those artists?
Well, we had Francis Bacon, which I'm not sure you see much in the editing, but he certainly had it right across the little portrait that was right across from where he was seated in his living room. We had Richters. I had a Turner. I had Monet. I had a Nicolas de Staël that was lovely. I had a little Schiller in Nicole's son's bedroom. I mean, there was all sorts of, but we had, you know, I don't have it in front of me, but it was a really interesting collaboration. It was really enjoyable.
I mean, it's sort of like, it's the ultimate fantasy collection, isn't it? Building it for somebody who doesn't exist and therefore doesn't have restrictions on budget, really, apart from the fact that, you know these, you know, particularly these characters within Succession and Billions, who you know would buy at that level. But I mean, it must be so exciting to examine the characterization of those people and their lives, and you have to almost imagine them choosing the artwork, selecting the artwork, talking maybe to their art advisor about the artwork. I mean, let's talk about Logan Roy, for instance. You know, an incredible character. Some people love him, some people hate him. No one's actually sure about his moral compass. How do you decide what Logan Roy collects?
Well, first of all, the age of the character is quite relevant to, you know, I mean, obviously what he would have, you know, considering his age, when did he start in his career to have enough money or to be interested in buy, where, you know, where as his children is, would have been different. And so they would obviously buy different things. That was also a thing with his current wife. You know, she brought in some contemporary art where he had collected and started collecting ways back. And I think that's also interesting, is to build, you know, and that is very relevant because then somebody will set up a collection in like 2 years and have it all hanging. So it often comes through a spectrum of time. And so it's interesting. And sometimes there've been several, you know, marriages and what they collected, which wife or which part of their career. And so it's all these things. And sometimes we don't know. We try to figure out, and with Nancy Myers on The Intern, we had many conversation on what Anne Hathaway's character would have had. So we decided that she would have mostly women artists, and then she had gone to art college, and then they were, what was her parents could have given her something. I mean, so you have to really create these characters who don't exist. And so it's a dialogue between many people. Mm. And it impacts also the costume designer. I mean, we really have to, it's a collaboration.
Who's been your most difficult character to curate for? Who's made you think, I'm not even sure that character would care about the artwork. Perhaps they would just be in it for the investment. Has there been any characters like that where you'd said,
That's not too hard either. Because then you know when it's there, you know, yeah. You know that it's just about the investment. So, you know, so you just figure out sort of the top 10 or the top 20. So actually that's not always, you know, it's not very interesting. Yeah. It's not interesting, but it's not hard.
It's just the ones with the highest returning, the big blue chip names.
So, you know, when you have to just go get blue chip, it's just sort of, you know, but sometimes it's really not that interesting. Yeah. I mean, the interesting ones is to figure out when they got things and why. And that's, you know, Oliver Stone, for instance, would make me do binders with all the artworks for Wall Street 2. I had to make a binders for each actors of all the artworks in the sets that they were shooting. So he'd give it to them and say, this is who you are. And I had to give all the artworks and the biography of the artist so they would know why, you know, this is what they had on their walls. So it really shows you that, you know, it's all about building the character and vice versa, and the impact.
I love that the actors use that to help them understand their character more. How did you decide what Shiv would collect?
For instance, the sun where I put the Frank Thiel's iceberg candle. So from his desk, he would see that iceberg come, you know, I mean, that was representing the relationship with his father. But I was in Succession, I was very lucky because we did it with Adam McKay, who created the character. I think Jess Armstrong was the only one that stayed on. But we all worked and it was really a team effort. We would all sit around, you know, and discuss what, and the same thing, the prop master would decide which car they had and what they would wear. I mean, sometimes you don't even know where it starts and when it finished because you're all on the same page. I mean, I remember in Logan's bedroom having some Egon Schiele that you actually originally saw only like half lit at night. But, you know, that sort of told you, because I remember he was getting up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and then you saw it with the lights not fully on. And so it had to be strong enough and dark. So, I mean, it has all these different things that come into consideration. But it depends. Each job is different. In Succession, I was very privileged to have Adam McKay really working with us on a daily basis on who the characters were. On Succession, we had sort of the same thing. I mean, Andrew Ross Sorkin was wonderful, because he would literally come in, you know, basically almost every day in the art department and discuss things with the director and us. And each show is different. And sometimes it's the producer that's the most hands-on, and sometimes it's the director, and sometimes it's neither of them. And you just have complete carte blanche and it's up to you. I mean, on Ocean 8, there was actually quite an interesting story, because when we did Sandra Bullock's boyfriend's character's apartment, we had a whole bunch of things, and it was reshot several times. So all the hero pieces are never seen in the movie. But one that was not supposed to be a hero piece is a Philip Guston painting. And I think it was in the left-hand lower corner, there's an ashtray with a cigarette butt. And Warner Brothers was totally against us using that painting because it was a cigarette butt and they have no smoking policy. And so I had, you know, and the production designer and the director says, no, we want that painting. You know, you're right. This is the right one. And you have to keep going up and up. And so I have to, you know, until like literally the day before shooting, because I think we had a snowstorm. So I got an extra bonus day to negotiate. And then it ended up being straight up front. So it was seen a lot more than it was planned originally. Oh, and but it was quite funny. And then I just saw at the Met, there was Philip Guston's daughter just gave a huge amount of her collection works of art at the Met this past week. And then it reminded me the story. And then there are some artwork definitely with cigarettes, because he was a bit heavy smoker. And in that period people smoked, so you can't erase it, you know. And then and you cannot alter. The good thing of using real artwork is that you have to use the real artwork, and you can't just, you know, take away the ashtray. Everything has a meaning, you know. And then it could, you know, the same thing as they could say when you have a Logan or axe, but they could have been smokers, so they would have, you know, they would be normal. So all these little details come into the character, and it's fun. I mean, it's just, you know, it's they exist in my mind for the duration of the project, and then they're gone.
they exist in all our minds. Tell me, how do you source these works? Are they reproductions all the time, or are they?
They're mostly, I would say, about 85 to 90% of the time, they're official reproductions. And right. That was really what's changed in the business, is to be getting the rights, the copyrights to the image of the artwork. And then, or some, you know, sometimes it's a reproduction that an artist will do for me. And then, you know, if it's a photographer, they will actually print it for me. They might change the contrast, because with a moving camera, it needs to have more contrast or less contrast, or it has to be darker or lighter. I mean, I've had, you know, I've had a $20 million Cy Twombly for half a day on a set for the movie Paranoia. And that brings a whole other set of logistics nightmare and insurance and getting, because it was on a location. So we had to secure elevation their shaft, and I had to follow it. And, you know, and for insurance purposes, where no one from the production was allowed to touch it. So we had to have the art handlers do it. When I waved that truck goodbye, it was like one of the most relieved I was. So I find it unnecessary most of the time. I've had, you know, very valuable originals, but usually for a very short time. And the intern, I had several of Robert De Niro Sr.'s artworks and on his set in his home. And it was very nice, because he gave me full access to all his father's artwork at his gallery, at his hotels, at his offices, his home, everything. And I picked, I think, four of them. And it was nice when he came to set to that he was pleased with what I had picked. And some of them you don't see, but, you know, very often we dress the walls that the actor is looking at. So they see their character all around, even though the camera is never going to shoot it. So yeah, part of our work is not always seen.
No, it's almost, it's a supporting role. It stands in the background so that that person can stay in character and see that artwork. And that's fascinating. Why would you, with the Cy Twombly, for instance, why would you not have that reproduced?
well, I can't get into the details, but it was just, you know, unfortunate. But anyway, it ended up being digitally inserted later on because it had a glass and it had a reflection. It didn't show up properly on the film.
Who reproduces these artworks?
Well, I'm part of the Scenics Union of America. 1999, we were doing them from scratch. You know, whether it was the Matisse or I mean, we even did a Anthony Gormley sculpture that we created, and that was a really fun experience. Now with technology, you know, that improves every year, every production, I get high definition prints that are on canvas or on paper if it's a work on paper, and then it's usually just touched up, you know, for to get the texture and all that. But now it's so good that if it's not a hero piece, sometimes we don't even need to touch it up. If it's far enough in the background, it looks exactly like the real thing. Mm-hmm. I've had the case with a collector that I can't name who actually came and whose house we shot and came in and said, "Oh my God, we forgot to take that painting down," because we actually liked one of the painting that this collector had. And so we reproduced it, and I had to run over and just take it off with my two hands off the wall and show her that it was all written in the back and that it was mine. And she's like, "Oh, that's not mine." I said, "No, it's not yours. It's mine." And she was so shocked. It was obviously that we had done a good job, that, you know, it looked so real that the owner thought it was her artwork and not the one that we reproduced.
And what happens to the artworks afterwards, these incredible reproductions?
Well, that's a key part of my job is I'm sometimes one of the last ones on payroll, is that I oversee the proof of destruction. So either it's returned to the copyright owner. So sometimes if it's an estate, the children or the grandchildren wants to have the copies because the artwork is in a collection, it's been sold and they haven't seen the artwork in decades, or it's in, you know, a museum or something. And sometimes artists want it back because sometimes they actually, you know, because it's printed on canvas, so they could use the canvas and the stretch frame and do another artwork. So it has a second life. And then, you know, most of the time I do proof of destruction, which means that I slash it up in pieces and somebody films me and takes pictures. And then I send the little, some tidbits, usually by FedEx. At the end, I have all these FedEx envelopes that go back so that they have the proof that we destroyed them.
Gosh, and it has to be destroyed after shooting.
Yeah, that's shooting. Yes.
So that there's, you know, so there's no risk at all that these are floating around on the market.
That's the key part of having artists, you know, collaborate, is that they have to know and trust you that you're going to do well by their artwork, that you're going to do a reproduction that's good enough that it looks like the real thing, and also that they will have it back or know that it's been destroyed.
Must be quite heartbreaking to destroy some of these reproductions.
I know. I sort of say that all these artworks are sort of my children for the duration. It's sort of like the gestation that I have them for several months. And then when I destroy them, they're gone.
But I suppose even though it's quite heartbreaking to destroy them, you know that you're doing right by the original, you know?
Absolutely. You know that's essential. Yes.
What's the most extraordinary reproduction that you've worked on?
Well, I think the most fun research-wise and then the outcome was working on Wall Street 2 with Oliver Stone and Christy Zia, the production designer, because Oliver wanted a Goya. And I said, well, look, you know, all the Goyas are at the Prado, so it's impossible that the character, that Gecko, would have a Goya unless, you know, there was one that was lost. So he says, well, we have to find it and we have to do that one. So that was a really fun research. And so we created like a small study. I did find some study of what was supposed to be the 10th one or something. And
the lost
Goya. So we created one that's sort of, you know, the sort of composite of what we could find. And that was also fun because we had to have, I think we did 4 or 5 copies of it, because the character destroys it in out of rage during a scene. So we could have to, you know, if we had to reshoot. So I think they destroyed 2 And then I think Oliver Stone kept a copy, and then the producer has a copy. It was quite special because, I mean, this was like a labor of love for a few weeks, that every day I would work with the scenic and go back and we'd say, okay. And then he would make, he had a row of all of them lined up and work on each of them one at a time. And so that was really fun, and it worked.
How important is it that you are accurate with, for instance, you know, you had to find the lost one because you're assuming that your audience know that, you know, one hasn't been available for public sale in X amount of years. How important is it that you are accurate, or can you sometimes just fudge it and say, you know, we'll create another Rothko that doesn't quite exist, or we know is in an institution and hang it on this character's wall?
Well, to me, it's essential. It's really important. We do use artwork that are in museums. But I mean, the Goyas are not going anywhere. I mean, the Prado is, that's it. So that's not, you know, but we do use some artwork that are in museums and are in public domain. But it is credible because now, you know, museums de-assess things themselves. I mean, there's certainly, I mean, obviously nobody's going to have the Mona Lisa or the Goyas, you know, that is totally on impossible. But no, I think it really is important. Otherwise, otherwise then it's gimmicky and it's a joke.
I love that it's so accurate, it's so important, even though, you know, perhaps most people watching wouldn't be able to recognize it. Do you ever get people write in about particular artworks that are shown and be critical about?
Yes, people do write in. Surprisingly enough, I'm not very good with social media, but I have sometimes directors or producers who will send me forward me an email or request on one of the social medias and say, could you tell, you know, who the artist is that was that and where they could find it. And so and sometimes way later. So I think people watching at home and they're able to stop the camera and then they take screenshots and say, who is that? And so it's actually fun that people, I think it's not just art. I mean, people are the audience are now much more educated and know that they could educate themselves. So whether it's they want to know about somebody's handbags or shoes or cars or the location or the restaurants, I mean, they ask questions about everything. And of course, they ask questions about art.
What's the most amazing space that you've had to curate an art collection for, perhaps in billions? The office obviously has quite a few monumental artworks in it.
Billions is really fun because we had this double height ceiling, and we installed those Aaron Young metallic plaque of burnt tires. And I had to have this special crane. And I mean, they stayed, I think, for a couple of seasons. It took several days of undertaking, and they looked fabulous. And it was really fun because I had to find something that looked good from below and from above and from across. And they were very heavy. So once they were in the wall, they weren't going anywhere.
What about Logan Roy and his residencies? Do you remember kind of starting with that characterization?
I mean, my thought is that he didn't start buying, collecting for investment. I think I had an Egon Schiele or something. I can't remember exactly, but I remember the Juan Gris on each side of the doorway. And I think, you know, considering his age, he would have bought them because they were the things that he was looking at the time. And then when you went into the next room, there was some very contemporary artist, the name slips my mind now, that his current wife would have bought because she wanted to be, you know, with the in crowd and be in the know. And so you could see also the generation gap, that they would obviously have different things. And I think that's really important. Sometimes when you see these characters of a certain age, you think, well, they bought, but no, they started buying with the means that they had at the time. And then it just happens that, you know, now it's worth multi-million dollars. You know, I mean, it was probably expensive when they bought it for what they had, but they were, you know, they were probably not billionaires when they bought them anyway. And so that has to be credible. People who expect me to work on their jobs expect that kind of, you know, the real story. Otherwise, you could just put anything.
What's the budget like for a production like Billions or Succession for reproductions of art? Like, how much does HBO spend on creating the art collection?
The budget is different. There's two different layers of the budget. There's the copyrights budget, So the clearance fees for them. And then depending on what kind of art, you know, I mean, I work very closely with the Artists' Rights Society and then directly with artists if they are live. And so so there's a budget for the clearance, and then there's the budget for the reproduction and the framing, which can be quite extravagant sometimes. Sometimes you'll have one huge painting and then it costs a lot more to make it because it's gigantic and a special truck to bring it in and to load it in and all these kind of things. But then you only have one, so there's only one's clearance fee. So it differs from, you know, how episodic is different because there's the built sets are there to stay. On series, I often come to do the built sets, you know, the pilots and the built sets, and those artworks stay for the whole season. So it's an investment to on, or like, I don't know how many episodes they're going to have, but then they'll just sort of wing it with things that are just for one scene here and there. So it all depends. And then sometimes they will bring me just for one scene because there is a specific thing that they need artwork. And I'm not going to tell you the show, but I've had a job where I was called to do ugly artwork. And you know, so I had to do the character was some con artist and, you know, CD person, and he would have all these artwork in his house, and it was had to be really ugly, and it was really quite challenging. There are artists that I don't particularly like that I use because I think they're the right people. But this was a very challenging thing because it had to be specifically ugly. And then when the crew arrived and they were looking at things and said, you know, did you get this? This is so ugly. I was like, oh, good. I did a good job. I had to really look hard, and it was quite interesting to look for ugly artwork.
In terms of a family like the Roys, do right. you throughout the series, do you find that they, and I know that you haven't worked on every single series, so, but you must be aware of what maybe moves through the family and what appears in other people's apartments. Is there a story in terms of succession itself around the art collection of the Roys?
I could say, for instance, there was a couple of things that we thought, you know, well, that this artist could have been a friend of her mother's, so she would have, her parents would have given it to her, and that's where she started from. And then she had her friends in college that were artists, so she collected them. And then, you know, so you try to create that with when you create characters, but that usually is thought, you know, I mean, when you start, that's what you know, you sort of, first of all, you think, where did they start? And where did it, you know, where did it come from? Just as well as the costume designer would say, you know, oh, well, she's actually, this is her mother's handbag, you know, and things like that. So, yeah, you have to think where they come from and where they're going, if it's going to be a series. But then you don't, you know, when I do, but you don't just know that it's going to be ongoing. You know, it's the series. You never know how many years it's going to go down and how many iteration it's going to go through.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite artwork that you've had to reproduce for a character?
Oh, God.
One that you really didn't want to destroy because actually you would have liked to have taken home.
Oh, there's so many I don't want to destroy. that's not even a question. Some of them I keep as long as I can. I keep them by my desk sometimes just to have them until I really have to. And then sometimes they go, you know, they go into storage for a long time. And then when the studio gives you the green light, I go back to the storage and destroy them. And then I revisit them because I hadn't seen them in 6 months or a year, you know, because sometimes it takes a long time between the time we shoot to the time the movie's ready to come out. Specific, you know, touch a point. It's either the artwork or how I found them or the copyright owners that was so special. I mean, on Changing Lanes, I used some of Alice Neal's artwork. And luckily, I was really happy. I didn't have to destroy them because the family wanted them. So I delivered them to Alice's daughter-in-law and grandson. And then they were going to have actually a family reunion and have those paintings. So it felt, you know, it was sort of a very feel good thing that I didn't have to destroy it. The most fun destruction was also on Changing Lanes because we did a reproduction of a Anthony Gormley sculpture. And we're trying to figure out how we're going to do the and Anthony being in the UK and us being shooting in Brooklyn. We were trying to figure out how to do the proof of destruction. And then the executive producer says, well, you know, we have the crane. Most of the stage is gone. why don't we just pull it up with the crane, and then we'll have a cameraman just, you know, videotape it. So we took the sculpture all the way to the top of the ceiling of the where we were shooting, of which was actually the armory, and then it was dropped, and then it was videotaped of the sculpture falling down and, you know, bursting into pieces. And then it was at the time still video cassettes, and I send it to Anthony Gormley, and I remember seeing him like a year or so later in London, and then he's like, oh, you have no idea, that is so much fun, I love watching it. And it was like, and I must say, I was sorry that I didn't get a copy of it, so that's one I would have liked to, you know, kept a copy of the video.
Your camera roll on your phone, or however you film these things being destroyed, if somebody came across it and just found all this footage of people destroying, you know, probably quite famous artworks in some respects, must be a bizarre but brilliant almost artwork in itself, you know, watching these.
Oh, I'm sure if my cloud is hacked, I'm sure they would have a lot of fun.
This person that destroys it. Have you ever approached an artist and said, we'd love to reproduce, or an artist's estate, we'd love to reproduce this for this character and this in this film or in this series, and they've said, no, I don't want my artwork associated with that story or that character? Have there ever been anything like that?
Well, I have, you know, people obviously requiring, they want to make sure that it's not being talked about badly, or that it's being, you know, trashed, or it's not being used to. I mean, I've had a rep asking, making sure that it wasn't being used for like drug dealing or something. And I've had really interesting questions. No, I usually, you know, first of all, they get a synopsis, and then I tell them where it's going to be and who are the characters that are going to be involved with it. That's the key. And then if it's mentioned, you know, there's also a whole other thing. For instance, on the sequel called Confess Fletch a couple of summers ago, it was all about this art theft and heist, and we had a Picasso, and the Picasso kept being mentioned more, and so every time the producer would call me and say, oh my god, you know, on set today, you know, we changed and it was mentioned one more time. So I had to go back to get the copyright for another line. And at the end, it had so many lines that we actually joked with the producer and said, you know, that basically that Picasso was probably fulfilling the requirements to get a SAG card, because it was mentioned so many times that it had enough line to have a SAG card. So, you know, sometimes there's a really funny things that happen with artwork.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Funny, I think it's absolutely fascinating. From our perspective, obviously, we broker prints and multiples in the secondary market. And so we deal with a lot of Andy Warhol, a lot of Banksy prints. How often do you use prints and multiples in scenes? Something like a whole set of Warhol's ads, or a whole set of Warhol's Marilyns. I mean, that's got screen power, hasn't it?
Yes, I mean, I haven't done it yet, but I'm certainly open. I actually used in The Undoing, I had a whole set, editing, you'd end up seeing it, much of it, but I had a set of prints, I think I had two or three original prints from Jeff Koons. So they came to set for a day, and there was the ones with the ranging ball, you know, was all these, there was one was the Klimt, and the other one I forgot, but it had the aluminum ball in the middle, and they have, you know, so I sometimes I do use prints. That's some of the cases where I would use the originals. I've worked also closely with some artists about creating for us. So on Billions, we had talks about doing some of that.
That's interesting. So creating a limited edition print to actually use in the show, but then it's allowed to live on because it is actually produced by the artist rather than a reproduction. Oh, that's very interesting.
And I've had photographers make prints at a specific size things for us, and then they get it back, and then it's a one of, and they could sell it and do whatever they want with it. It's art, you know, approved. So yes, some of the artworks actually have a secondary life after film.
I think it's fascinating that you're now starting to see in provenance when something goes on sale at auction, it, you know, in the same way that you would say see it exhibited at MoMA, you also see its credentials in its movie career. You know, I think that's amazing that that's now become part of an artwork's history and associated. Is there an artwork that you can think of that's been associated with a particular character that's gone on to sell it auction and perhaps has had an influence on its value?
At auction, not sure, but what was quite fun is I used an Alex Katz in Changing Lanes in Ben Affleck's office. And it had been noticed by a lot of people because it was across from his desk. And that one scene, you know, he actually sits under it. In this case, when he's sitting under the artwork, it's actually telling you, and he's debating whether he's going to stay in that rat race to climb to become a partner in the law firm or just take off and walk on the beach. And the Isle of Cats in the back is this man walking on the beach. And we were able to, with Alex Katz's approval, able to do it exactly half the size because it was this monumental painting. And so we could fit it on our set. And then about, I would say, 4 or 5 years later, the original in the full size was for sale at, I think it was the Armory Show or the Frieze Fair, one of those. And so it was really funny. I was like, oh my God, there's my Alex Katz. And it was for sale. And then I've had people come up to me because in Stepford Wives, for instance, I have several Andreas Gursky. One of them is when Nicole Kidman actually gets fired. And then in the background, and you don't see it, you don't hear any noise because she's behind, you could see her from the outside. Out of this glass office, and in the background there's the boxing ring, and that's basically there's boxing in behind her being, you know, fired. And then I've had people come up to me and says, yo, you know, I own that print, that artwork from Gursky. It has a life of its own once it's gone, you know, once it's on. And that's where I think, you know, it's really been the key thing, and I think that was the vision of Scott Rudin, is that artists now feel that they're part of the same art world and with the films and their art. And I think for some of them are very cooperative and understand that, you know, that it's actually to everybody's benefit. Because it's better for the real artwork, and it's better for the artist that it's the real artwork.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a collaboration, really, isn't it, of creative elements that brings that scene alive. Bobby Axelrod, we have to just talk about him. What was the brief there? Like, how do you capture a character like Axe in his art collection?
Well, my starting point was the Basquiat. And that he could see the Basquiat from his desk. And then, you know, then I had a Christopher Wool that said trouble on the other wall. And I thought, you know, I mean, fine, it was a little quite in your face. And then on the other corner, I had the Gabriel Orozco, those calculations that are, you know, so it's all about what's calculating his mind. And then when he's walking that hallway all the time, having those Aaron Young tire marks is also, you know, he's ruthless, you know, there's those tire marks that, you know, that he's doing. So it was fun. I mean, and then I had a whole bunch of things. I had lots of currency works in the trading floors and his office. I mean, it was, you know, it was really fun.
Those three works, the Basquiat, Christopher Wool, I mean, like those absolutely typify it, don't they? I mean, it's so brilliant. And who would be Bobby Axelrod's favorite artist?
What he liked was, I think the Basquiat really, anybody knows. So I think what was important to him is that if you just walked in, you knew what it was. You know, Basquiat more than anybody else, because not everybody will know what a Christopher Wool is, even though you could read that says it's trouble, but, you know, or anyone else. I think where the Basquiat, I think now is, you know, generally.
I think they call that flex appeal, don't they? The flex artwork, and there's the trend with flex artwork. And I think, you know, these characters like the children in Succession and certainly Bobby Axelrod, art as an asset.
Right.
Is what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, if it was just an asset, they'd probably, yeah, have a Hockney, or, I mean, Jeff Koons was probably the major asset to have, I would say, you know, maybe 6 years or ago. Now you just have to go through the trend, and then now they hopefully would have some women artists, you know, more prevalent. And, you know, and I would think hopefully the woman character would also have, you know, women.
Yeah, artists. I like to think that Shiv would collect more female artists.
That's what I would do if, you know, if I was dealing with her now.
Monumental female up and coming, both primary and secondary markets. What a dream job, honestly. Like, who would work in the real art world when you can just curate for characters like these? I mean, yeah, we thought we were lucky.
It's a dream, but I happen to find it, you know, exciting because every day is different. And not that I would ever want to be an art consultant, but you deal with the same characters for hopefully a long time, where in my case, you know, it's a whole different team. It's a whole different bunch of characters every few months. So it's always renewed. And I basically drive any algorithm research crazy, but that's okay.
When we see a spike in traffic around certain artworks, it's funny doing research. I think obviously, you know, the difference is that you're not actually pleasing a different type of client. You're pleasing the viewer, and that characterization of that character, rather than having to please a real person with a set of budgetary conditions. Having said that, you've got budgetary decisions to make against the set and the production, I suppose. So yeah.
I do have budgets, but sometimes you're really doing you're obviously highlighting the billions in Succession or Wall Street of, you know, but some of the other things are actually sometimes much more fun and having less known artists and finding the right artist that would tell the story is sometimes much more rewarding and exciting, because that really helps tell the story. And then people don't, you know, sometimes if people recognize too well who it is, then they're more distracted by the fact that it's so-and-so than what the artwork is really saying. So,
yes. Yeah.
So that's,
interesting consideration.
There's two sides to it.
Mm-hmm. Fanny, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really, really interesting.
Well, thank you for having me.